Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's grilling of the chairman of the Fed by freshman Senator Elizabeth Warren over the extent to which the big banks are too big to fail and whether they deserve an $83 billion subsidy that is about the same as the impending sequester cuts. Jennifer Taub, a professor at the Vermont School of Law and former Associate General Counsel for Fidelity Investments, joins us to discuss how the big banks are smashing the little banks, something that Ben Bernanke told Senator Warren he agreed with 100%. Then we will speak with economist Richard Wolff about the irony that the politician responsible for the European banks imposing austerity on Italy has made a comeback as the anti-austerity champion and now threatens to unravel the slow and painful gains Europe has made in stabilizing the euro. We'll also discuss a very similar situation here in the United States, where the gradual recovery of our economy, devastated since 2008 from the Wall Street crash, is likely to be reversed by House Republicans in the next few days. Then finally, we'll examine what is at stake in a federal appeals court case tomorrow in Manhattan, where the U.S. government has joined in the defense of Argentina to prevent vulture capitalists from undoing a settlement between Argentina and its creditors. Eric Lecomte, the director of the Jubilee USA Network, joins us to explain how vulture capitalists like Paul Singer, who buy third world debt for pennies on the dollar, are able to get a federal judge to give them priority in getting 100% of the debt repaid in full ahead of other lenders and creditors who have agreed to settle for much less. Joining us now is Jennifer Taub, who is a professor at the Vermont Law School. Previously, she taught at the University of Massachusetts Amherst Eisenberg School of Management and worked for Fidelity Investments as an associate general counsel. Her new book from Yale Press, Perpetual Crisis, How Decades of Regulatory Failure Floated Banks and Sunk Homeowners, will be out in 2014. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Taub.
Thank you for having me here, Ian.
And I apologize, I've still got this horrible cough, but... So just bear with me, Jennifer. Now, the testimony today was pretty impressive. I must say, Elizabeth Warren is no shrinking violet, and she is exactly what the U.S. Senate needs instead of these sort of vacuous, pontificating, you know, establishment types. You know, she's actually trying to get some answers on the behalf of the people of the United States. And not that Ben Bernanke's a bad guy, but she really grilled him.
She did, and she really is living up to what her supporters thought she would deliver. She is standing up for the people, and she's continuing now in her role as a senator to demand answers and to point out what really is quite obvious, that the banks are still too big to fail. And that is, and the choices that we have made really to help the banks, the largest banks, survive and thrive has been at the expense of both taxpayers and homeowners and really the broader economy.
One of the issues, as well as the too big to fail exchanges between Chairman of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, and Elizabeth Warren, the other exchange was about the $83 billion subsidies that the big banks get, which was came out of a study by Bloomberg. And I guess the subsidy is that given the implicit support that the federal government gives the banks, in other words, not allowing them to go under because they are too big to fail, is worth about $83 billion a year to these banks, whose profits, by the way, are about $83 billion. And more importantly, and this really I find galling, $83 billion is only $2 billion less than what is about to hang up this entire U.S. economy over, the sequester cuts.
You're right. Let me just talk a little bit about Bloomberg's research on that. And the irony of that number, too. And Bloomberg put out a report looking, trying to calculate what the subsidy is. And what they meant and what they mean by that is that the largest banks, whom creditors believe will never be allowed to fail, they're able to borrow for less and fund their balance sheets. And banks are highly leveraged and depend upon funding. They're allowed to borrow up to $97 for every $100 in assets that they own. And so when they borrow, the cheaper that, you know, the less they have to pay in terms of interest on what they take in, the more their profits are. And you mentioned how ironic it is that the $83 billion annual subsidy that these banks receive is quite close to what we're fighting over right now in terms of the sequester, and how devastating for the entire society an $85 billion cut would be. What's also ironic about that figure, and it ties into what the chairman of the Fed is talking about today, is that $85 billion is about how much each month the Fed, through its quantitative easing program, is buying up in terms of bonds. And so what's really sad right now is that the country is once again being held hostage to a manufactured crisis. This is the same thing as a fiscal cliff, just postponed some more. And what's terribly sad is that this is a manufactured crisis, where, and to some degree, the financial crisis of 2008, we can also see as a manufactured crisis, something that was manufactured over many decades through deregulation and regulatory failure. So I think, you know, the power really is in Washington to make this better and to stand up and do what's right to help this economy get back, get strong again, instead of this choice to make us suffer some more.
The big banks, in effect, only have to hold $3 in reserve for every $100 that they borrow.
It's not exactly reserve that they're permitted in terms of leverage. They're permitted to fund their balance sheets. They're permitted to borrow up to $97 to use that funding to purchase assets. You know, a good deal of these large banks, the funding is from deposits, but some of it also comes from very, very short-term, sometimes overnight loans, which make their balance sheets extremely, extremely fragile. And as you know, just speaking of the banks, the largest bank is J.P. Morgan Chase. It has over $2 trillion in assets right now.
Well, the while Bernanke was having this vigorous exchange with Senator Warren, by the way, they didn't disagree on a number of things. At the end, Bernanke agreed with Senator Warren that the big banks are getting a terrific break and little banks are getting smashed. And to which,
and he agrees that they're still too big to fail. He just hopes that the solutions through Dodd-Frank will one day be apparent to the marketplace, and they'll no longer enjoy that subsidy. But it's been a long time, and it hasn't changed.
So while this is happening at the Senate, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, is talking about how the benefits of being too big to fail, and in effect, he's saying that your pain is my gain. This bank is anti-fragile. We actually benefit from downturns.
Yes, I'm stunned in so many ways by Jamie Dimon's comment, the sheer hubris of it, how it's tone deaf, but also that he made a reference by calling J.P. Morgan Chase anti-fragile. That's a reference to Nassim Taleb's latest book. And in fact, Taleb was, if you follow this on Twitter, was quite surprised that his book title was being misused. He doesn't perceive J.P. Morgan Chase as anti-fragile.
Well, I did read the exchange. Yes, he's quite miffed about it. But Jamie Dimon, of course, is a very powerful figure, and exemplifies this sort of financial aristocracy we have, who seem to be immune from any political influence. If you saw the Frontline documentary questioning why nobody's gone to jail for the 2008 crash, they're immune. They're above the law, apparently. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it? That I suppose it's not surprising they're arrogant.
Right. I mean, if you consider the fact that this is the same person who, just about a year ago, was calling what was later to be found out to be the London Whale fiasco, calling it a tempest in a teapot, and pretty soon it grew in a matter of months from a tempest in a teapot to a $6 billion trading loss.
For J.P. Morgan Chase.
Right. And, that this is the same thing, so I find it difficult to be certain of the veracity of the statements he makes about his bank. And you're right. If you know, when you look at the too big to fail, the too big to manage, the too big to regulate, and now the too big to jail problem, you know, looking at HSBC is a prime example. You know, here we are expecting folks to be held accountable where there was criminal wrongdoing with the 2008 financial crisis. But if you look at HSBC, when there's evidence of criminal violations, you know, for money laundering, and there's actually criminal culpability there, but nobody goes to jail, one sort of loses hope about the rule of law when it comes to these giant institutions. And when the justification there that we heard from the government was that one had to take into account the impact of charging an institution of that size with a felony, that was the justification, which is basically too big to jail writ large, but also that, you know, no answer for why individuals who were responsible weren't held criminally liable. And just to tie back to your comment earlier about Elizabeth Warren, Ian, when she was comparing large banks to small banks, you can just juxtapose HSBC to some small institutions around the same time where folks in charge were held criminally liable and sentenced for responsibility for money laundering. So there definitely is this double standard.
And of course, just to finish up on JPMorgan Chase, they were able, thanks to the largesse of the government, they were able to buy Bear Stearns at a fire sale price from the government, and they got a $25 billion TARP fund bailout. And of course, they're a part of the $83 billion subsidy that the big banks get per year, which we've already discussed. So. What's your sense then of where Dodd-Frank stands? The Republicans have fought it tooth and nail. They've managed to even get a court in Washington to throw out recess appointments. So the new head of the most important part of Dodd-Frank, which is the brainchild of Elizabeth Warren's, and that is the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, or Bureau, I should say. He's now in limbo. So, what's your sense of how, you know, Elizabeth Warren's obviously fighting the good fight, but how is Dodd-Frank doing in the face of this relentless guerrilla war from the Republicans?
Well, you know, Dodd-Frank is a good first step, but it's a baby step. And looking back on it, I think it's clear that trying to do incremental regulation or trying to delegate to agencies, for example, things like the Volcker Rule, which was meant to be a substitute for the Glass-Steagall-type separation of high-risk banking from the public subsidy and plain vanilla banking, that idea that it would happen incrementally and that we could really trust regulators to make strong rules hasn't been the case. So I think that what was left on the cutting room floor that didn't make it into Dodd-Frank, things like the Brown-Kaufman Amendment, which would have broken up banks by size, for example, or other ideas about big structural reforms are necessary. And I do hold out some hope. I was just at a conference in Washington last month at the AFL-CIO, and one of the folks on my panel was Simon Johnson, who I know has been on the show. And, you know, he was talking about, again, the need to break up the banks, given the enormous political power they wield, as well as the danger they present to the financial system and the economy. And who he mentioned at that moment was an opinion piece by George Will. And so you have, I think the reason why there is a prospect of making a significant change is that the progressive left as well as the conservative right understand that this is not the market operating and that this is a distortion and the distortion must stop. And so, you know, there are plenty of names I could name drop here. I won't go through them, but as you know, there is a groundswell of support. And I think the public is beginning to understand that we need to go back and basically go back to the good ideas that didn't make it into the legislation and too big to fail by really literally saying that banks that are too big need to be made smaller. And this is not a radical suggestion. We're talking about reducing their size. If you look at the Senator Brown, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, has reintroduced this. We're talking about reducing them roughly back down to the size they were in the 90s, before the full repeal of Glass-Steagall and so on.
So, Jennifer Tower, professor of the Vermont Law School, previously taught at the University of Massachusetts Amherst Eisenberg School of Management and worked for Fidelity Investments as an associate general counsel. So at this moment, you know, where we're facing the self-inflicted wound of $85 billion coming out of the economy and the brinksmanship that's going on, which doesn't look like it's going to yield anything or prevent this unnecessary catastrophe from this manufactured crisis, it would seem that this is a ripe, teachable moment, and one would hope that the president could use it. I mean, if the president, I think, told the American people, by the way, this entire amount of $85 billion, that's what the federal government effectively subsidizes the biggest banks with every year, wouldn't that resonate?
It might, but I listened to this State of the Union address, the last major major address of the president's, and during that he did not properly contextualize where we are right now. In fact, the way he described things is that we had cleared away the rubble of the crisis, as if we were now the public and the economy had fully recovered from this crisis, which he didn't name. He didn't talk about the banks. He didn't talk about underwater homeowners and the fact that 4 million people have lost their homes to foreclosure and why we are struggling. You know, he didn't talk about the reason why this has been, why unemployment and underemployment is still so high. And part of, and without doing that, then people don't fully understand the need to continue to finish the reform that still is necessary. I would like to contrast that to a talk by the vice chair of the Fed, Janet Yellen, who just the very same day, of the State of the Union address, she talked about the headwinds against recovery, and one of them is the fact that in previous recoveries, housing has kind of led the recovery, and right now that's not happening. There are a number of reasons. In part, it's because people are, don't have the capacity to borrow. In part, it's because of this, of underwater homes and people who've lost tremendous equity in their homes. So that's happening, and so we talk about these headwinds for the recovery. And today, Bernanke is talking about how this, the $85 billion sequester, if that happens, will be another headwind. And so I agree with you. It would be wonderful if the president put this in historical context so that the pieces fit together for people. But I don't have much hope for that, given how he avoided that at the State of the Union.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jennifer Taub.
Thank you so much, Ian.
We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how painful economic gains in both Europe and the United States are about to be reversed.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound. Can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.